quiet people, because his mind is balanced wherever it is quiet. What we really have a confusion is his mind balanced there. So we have to get rid of the confusion.
Broadcasting from Foothill College.
Let the comet mind balance in peace.
This is KFJC, Los Altos Hills.
So we couple Amsterdam vibration with Jamaica and make it a perfect Alpha and Omega.
on 89.7 KFJC. Soundtrack music there by Mr. Fred Frith, who is going to be our special guest for the next 4 hours here in the studio. And we'll let Fred, who is sitting right here across from me, tell us a little bit about what we just heard.
Having just got here, I'm not quite sure we just heard, but we just heard a little bit of Rivers and Tides.
It was part one, yes.
Yeah, so that was the soundtrack material from a film by Thomas Riedelsheimer about the land artist Andy Goldsworthy, which I composed, I guess, about 4 or 5 years ago. A film which was especially popular in the Bay Area, as it turned out.
Yeah, I know a lot of people who saw it who liked the music and didn't know anything about the person who did it. However, when I went and saw it, I said, oh boy, this is going to be good, because I knew, you know, more about the music than I did about the actual film itself.
And then there's a third category of person who heard the music without knowing that I did it and said, hey, wait a minute, I know who did that.
Just from hearing it, you think?
Yeah.
So what were you playing on that? I know you're a multi-instrumentalist, and I think you do percussion and stuff besides the guitar that people know you for. What was the musical layout of the soundtrack?
One of those rare luxuries, I was actually working to pretty much the final cut. Normally, you know, you very often end up working with something which is not finished, so you don't really know how it's going to be at the end. But I was actually working to picture in its final state, which was very nice. And in this particular case, as I did with Middle of the Moment, which was the film soundtrack that you heard before this one, which was a film by Nicholas Humbert and Werner Pencil about the Tuareg, which was done in the early 90s. In both cases, I actually started the soundtrack from the same basis, which was to ask the filmmakers to provide me with a comprehensive set of recordings of the location filming, so that it wasn't necessarily things that were in the film, but things that had happened while they were filming that they had recorded in audio. And in the case of the Goldsworthy film, I was very interested to see what it sounded like when he was working. And, for example, when he's working on the ice sculpture in the very early hours of the morning up in Canada, his hands were so cold that he kept dropping bits of ice on the floor. There's one moment of that in the film, but there were actually a lot of moments of it that were recorded. And I took some of those, which were very resonant, and sampled them. So I ended up having a kind of a virtual marimba made up of the sound of ice dropping. And the instruments that I use to accompany that scene include the very material which you're hearing in the scene itself. So there's a kind of an organic connection between what I'm doing musically, although I'm composing it, not just letting it be what it is, but actually creating a kind of a composition around it. So on that particular ice sculpture piece, I was using ice, and I think I had a berimbau and a violin and, you know, whatever was lying around in the studio, probably, as it turned out. But throughout the film, I was trying to make this connection. So if I hear, if I see leaves tied together with hair, I'm thinking, what do I have that has hair in it? And the answer is a violin bow. So then I use the violin bow on the guitar to produce that kind of fragility, which I see as being part of the scene. Or when I see the stonemasons constructing the wall, I sample those sounds of them working and turn that into a kind of percussion instrument and play with that to more kind of enhance what they're doing in the film. So
I didn't realize you were actually using sounds from the location. I understand that you would be inspired by them, but I didn't think you were actually taking ice sounds and sounds like, you know, with them.
It's all tied up together. I like working that way. And the in the previous film, The Middle of the Moment, there were moments where the filmmakers, for example, there's a scene where you see the Tuareg crossing the desert. It's a long scene where you just get the relentless sense of movement with the donkeys and camels and everything moving along, and lots of harness sounds. And they wanted kind of road movie music, especially because they weren't being... It's ironic that in a film which is very romantic and seems to be about a way of life that's dying, part of it is because they were not allowed to show what was really going on, which is that they're smuggling Sony TV sets into Libya on the back of their wagons. But the fact is that there was nothing I could have added to that scene that wasn't already there. The harness was making the most incredible rhythm. The rhythm track itself was great. Yeah. So my composition, if you like, was to say to the filmmakers, I'm not going to add anything to that, but you must have it really loud, so turn it way up. And they were gracious enough to agree, and as a result you hear really the intricate details of the rhythm of the sound of the movement, which is much more interesting than anything I could have done.
When you said turn up the volume, that reminds me of both Step Across the Border and Middle of the Moment, where there's times when you're looking at something in black and white, a very stark thing on the screen, and you're hearing the sound of it, but it's very exaggerated, whether it's a piece of paper blowing or, you know, something blowing in the breeze or something. You know, you could just hear it as if it was hugely magnified, which really, really calls your attention to what you're seeing there, instead of just hearing it in the background and sort of, you know, ignoring it more or less because you're so busy looking at it.
Well, there's music all around us all the time. It's just you just have to focus on it and decide that that's what it is. It's our choice. We can always choose to decide that something's musical. That's one of the things I like about the Riedelsheimer film Touch the Sound, about Evelyn Glennie, and which I also participated in. But the sound design for that film, which won a lot of prizes, is just relentless. It's really a film for the ears as much as it is for the eyes. You're in the cinema experiencing kind of everything to do with hearing, which is very kind of bittersweet when you know that the protagonist of the film can't hear. So it's very electric for me.
I particularly like the scene in the airport where you're hearing the people going clunk, 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 right, and they're walking, and you're hearing all the machinery and the suitcases rolling, and it's just like, wow, that's... It is truly all around you. Now, is that something you think she probably wasn't really hearing that, or is hearing it in some sense?
I think she hears it very well. She just hears it in a different way.
Yeah.
What I learned from working with her was, because I really wanted to do that film, I was really badgering Tomas that I really wanted a role in that film. And the thing about it was... I could understand how somebody who's hard of hearing could read a score, and I could understand how they could follow a conductor, but I didn't understand how they would be able to improvise, so I wanted to test that for myself. And we actually meet in the film and play together in the film for the first time, so it was a big risk on the part of the filmmaker to see if actually anything was going to come out of it. But within about a second of our playing together, all of those kinds of things were not being thought about anymore. We were just getting on with it. She hears with every single pore in her body, so she always jokes that she can hear much better than I can because she can hear much longer than I can. She's very sensitive to sound in every way.
Yeah, you would have to be. I mean, you would just, anything you could hear would become so important, you know. You would never be tuning anything out, I wouldn't think.
It reminds me of an exercise that I used to do in a workshop with Amanda Miller, who's a choreographer I work with, and we did joint workshops, and she would have dancers doing exercises, and one of the exercises was to make them project the idea of breathing through different parts of their body. So she would ask them to breathe through their elbows or breathe through their knees and see what it did to their movement, and it was and I participated in that, and it was quite revelatory, actually.
Now, would you do anything similar to that musically when you say you participate in workshops and things? So things that you teach and you conduct, I mean, different ways of looking at something rather than just playing your instrument, getting a different perspective on it. Is that something that you would normally include in your workshop?
Absolutely. At the start of a new cycle at Mills, I usually work in kind of two-year cycles. But when we start the ensemble in the beginning of a two-year cycle, I make the students not bring instruments at all. We start off doing only voice or other movement exercises, and there are a lot of different reasons for it, one of which is just to get to know each other without having the encumbrance of an instrument, and also without having the hierarchy that sets itself up when you have people who play instruments better than other people, and better in parentheses. So it's a way to equalize everybody, and so if we all can make complete idiots of ourselves mutually, at least we can get that out of the way and then work without thinking about that kind of side.
It takes away the intimidation factor, I think,
right,
if there's different levels of musical ability.
Of course, some people hate it, but... You know. There's always going to be somebody who hates.
That's
it.
Not what they came for. Or they just
they think it's childish, probably, which it is, hopefully.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk a little bit more about your teaching at Mills. I'd like to hear something from that Evelyn Glennie CD. It's called Sugar Factory. It's out on Zadig. Would you happen to know which of these, some of these pieces that are not in the film? If people have seen the film, then they know what you're talking about. But I'd like to play something that wasn't used in the film.
Well, when I make a Well, there's two different conversations here. One is that when I make a film soundtrack record, I very rarely just do what a film soundtrack record is supposed to be. In other words, just put the stuff that's on the film onto the record. I find that not very interesting, because good film music will only ever function in relationship to the image. And so if you see it without the image, hear it without the image, it usually doesn't work very well. So every film soundtrack record that I've ever done, I've recomposed the music in order to make it kind of like a film for your ears. So there's stuff in there that you won't see in the film, but which will give you a much stronger idea of the film than if I just left the music alone. In this particular case, the interest is in the fact that the film scenes of the sugar factory, which was actually a disused factory in the north of Germany that they'd rented. It was hard to find a factory that hadn't been turned into an art center, which is very ironic. Yeah. It was the only one left that hasn't become something else. But we found the factory, and the film is predicated on the idea that we're going there to make a record, which was completely artificial. I mean, they basically set up a studio in the factory and we recorded everything, but it was really a pretext for the film. So we didn't actually think we were going to make a record necessarily. It was just a thing to hang the film narrative on. But having made all the recordings, we did, of course, listen to them. And so what you hear on the Sugar Factory on the Tzadik record, as opposed to the soundtrack record, which is something I had nothing to do with, but which is, you know, got all the other material on it, what you hear on the Tzadik record is us completely recomposing what we did and adding things to it and taking it away and editing it and changing it. So these are compositions based on what we recorded in the Sugar Factory with things added to them and changed in them. So it's kind of a reworking of the material. So nothing on the record is what you see in the film.
Well, I misunderstood. I thought, you know, I'd heard the music in the film, and it wasn't an entire CD's worth of music, so I thought you must have recorded some things and just not used them, but now I understand it's a whole different mentality.
There is a soundtrack for the film which contains everything that's in the film, probably at its full length, as opposed to the fragmented form that you find it in the film. So a lot of stuff that I'm not involved in, for example. It's actually a very beautiful record. I recommend it. But this is something else. This is the record that we went there to record, not really, but actually.
Yeah.
In the end, we did it anyway.
That was an amazing space there, just from the film. I mean, I thought it was great. According to the way the film was edited, anyway, you walk in, and then it seems like within 15 seconds, you're running around bowing everything that you can think of, that you can find, and clanking on things just to hear what sounds are actually there in the space. I mean, it probably wasn't quite that immediate, but
that's... It was pretty much, because of the way they set it up. Evelyn's tech assistant had already set up all of her equipment, and they'd set up the studio, and they'd set up the cameras, and we arrived being filmed just to see what would happen. And actually the first thing that happened was that we started exploring the space, which I think is what you do when you arrive in any space. If you're an improviser, the space is integral to what you're going to do musically. You can't ignore it, you can't pretend that it's not there, so you deal with the space for what it is. And this was an astonishing space with all kinds of weird stuff in it, not least pigeons, which were singing to us all the time while we were working.
Alright, which track should we hear off this?
Well,
give me a number and a title, please.
Let's hear number 3, A Rag of Cults.
Number 3. Coming right up. It's KFJC 89.7 FM and the Fred Fritz Special Rough Edges, and we'll be here until 4 p.m.
on KFJC 89.7 FM. Fred Frith music there from the film by Sally Potter, The Tango Lesson. And Fred is here in the studio with us. And Fred, why don't you tell us a little bit about what we just heard?
One of the peculiar things about recording stuff is that you get to play with people that you never actually meet. This version of Astor Piazzolla's Liber Tangos, the lead voice is Yo-Yo Ma, who I've never met, but during the shooting of The Tango Lesson, Sally wanted to set up some sessions with me, because I work on all of her movies usually as a kind of the last person to have anything to do with the soundtrack. She usually calls me in after everything else has been recorded and has me improvise here and there, linking different things together and kind of gluing it all together and bringing it into one kind of world that she can then do what she wants with afterwards. And in this case, she wanted to fly me to Buenos Aires and play on the version of The Tango Lesson that Yo-Yo Ma was going to do with a Argentinian band. And this was since the soundtrack part of the film deal, this was a big Universal film deal. It was a film that had Johnny Depp and people in it, so it was a lot of it was out of her control, which she didn't particularly enjoy. Mm. But they said, no way. He can't go to Buenos Aires. We're not going to do that. So they did it without me. And it was all being done in parallel to Yo-Yo Ma doing a record of his own of tangos. So it kind of tied into the deal from Sony's perspective. And she got the recording from Buenos Aires and said, yeah, but actually, I do need to have Fred on there. So I ended up flying to London, which was actually rather more expensive for them, and spending a day in the studio overdubbing on that piece, and I ended up doing all kinds of stuff. It's very subtle, but I'm playing drums and bass and violin and guitar on that recording. So I ended up doing far more than was originally intended, for far more money than Sony originally intended to spend. I don't know whether Yo-Yo Ma actually put it on his version of his record. Probably not, but at least I get to be on the film version.
Was he aware that Fred Frith was going to end up being on that?
I have no idea.
You have no idea?
No.
So you missed out on a vacation to Buenos Aires anyway.
Another time.
Let's see, I was going to say something. I forgot what I was going to say, darn it. There's another Sally Potter film here called Yes, and we've got a track lined up from this. You want to talk about this one a little bit, the film and your involvement in it?
Well, what I love about working with Sally, I mean, I've been working with Sally for a very long time, and I knew her first as a musician before she even started making films. We used to improvise together back in the 70s in Britain. So we go back a long way, and I work on all her films, and I have a very good empathy with her. And I love the fact that she takes huge risks. Every film she makes embodies some kind of a risk, and she's absolutely unafraid of that. She would much rather take the risk than not. And Yes is a film which is entirely in verse. So there's a Joan Allen and Simon Abkarian are the main characters, and it's about a Lebanese doctor who comes to Britain and can't work as a doctor because they won't allow him to practice with his qualifications. So he ends up working in a kitchen, and she's the wife of a politician who ends up meeting him at a function of her husband's, and what ensues. I won't spoil the film for you, but the whole thing is in verse, which is incredibly radical when you see it. It's really quite unusual. And one of the things that she wanted me to do, we recorded the soundtrack in Paris, my part of it. She always uses lots of different music, so I never do the whole thing. But she wanted to use an instrumental piece that Tom Waits composed. And this is a piece called Fawn. And I listened to the original and said, you know, there's a great violinist who happens to be in Paris, which was Carla Kielstedt. So it would be great if we can get her to come and do it. What I didn't know was that the original Tom Waits recording, she actually played the violin part, and that Tom Waits had said, you may have this song and arrange it on condition only that you don't use violin on it. So that was all kind of weird. And I ended up using an octave raised guitar with an e-bow, which is a very eerie and beautiful sound. But the other side of it, when I discovered that Carla had played on the original, I finally saw the credits. I noticed that Matthew Sperry had also played the bass part, who's a bass player from San Francisco who was unfortunately killed in a bicycle accident a few years back. So I ended up doing a kind of an homage to Matthew, with whom I'd played and who I knew slightly. So I played double bass for the only time in my life on record on this track as a kind of memory for him. So that's what we're going to hear.
Okay, we'll hear that on KFJC 89.7 FM.
Thank you.
89.7 KFJC and music from
Leslie DeLaba,
yeah.
Fred Frith, Gino Robert, Matthew Sperry, which was recorded in Tuva Space in 2001. And Leslie is a wonderful musician who I've been working with since the late 70s when we were both living in New York. And she and I and Gino will be playing on June 2nd as part of the Matthew Sperry annual festival, information about which you can get from matthewsperry.org.
And where is that taking place?
I'm not sure. I'll find out.
Is Tuva Space still around, or is that...
No, I don't think it's long gone.
I haven't heard anything about that for quite a while. Yeah.
Anyway, we're going to be joined by a young bass player, Jason Hoop, who I've been playing with lately. So it'll be a quartet. And I'm really looking forward to it. And that kind of was just coming out of the Tom Waits rearrangement. It seemed like a logical place to go.
Yeah. Okay, there's another collaboration here that you brought me here. Why don't you talk about this one a little bit? It's the one with Stevie Wishart and Carla Kilstead.
Well, we were talking about Carla a little earlier. And, you know, Carla, as we all know, is a phenomenon and is equally comfortable playing extremely challenging avant-garde music compositions and playing in Sleepy Time Gorilla Museum and all stages in between, and a remarkable improviser as well, which is a rare combination. I think the 21st century musician is she's kind of a perfect model of what those kinds of musicians should be. She can basically do anything,
yeah,
and is open to everything and doesn't have a vested interest in any one way of doing things. And I'm delighted that she and Matthias Bossi are both in my new band Cosa Brava, which, alas, I will not be able to play you because I know that if I do, it will end up on YouTube.
Oh, no.
unfinished, unmixed material.
I understand completely, but I would like to hear more about it at some point during the day, talk a little bit about the band and the concerts you have been done and things like that.
Absolutely. I met Carla when I was trying to record a violin part with my old friend Miles Boyson in his studio in Oakland, and after I'd been playing for sawing away for a couple of minutes, he said, "You know, I do know a very good violin player if you'd like a telephone number." And we kind of stopped in some mirth, but we did actually call her, and she did actually play the part, sight reading it. And
he thought you should be replaced.
Very much thinking I should be replaced. Quite right too. Anyway, she's been working on my compositions ever since, and I'm very grateful to it for it. And it's one of the jewels of the Bay Area. I've met a lot of great musicians since I've been here, and I'm very happy to have made that connection. And this record we're going to listen to is a trio with her and I and Stevie Wishart, who's an Australian hurdy-gurdy player, who was out a few years ago performing at Mills, actually, and we took advantage of the opportunity to do some improvising together. And Stevie and I play together occasionally in Europe. In fact, we're going to be taking part together in the fall of this year, I think in October, at a festival in London, which combines early music improvisation and contemporary improvisation, because that's really her area of interest. She's apart from being a hurdy-gurdy player and an electronics whiz and an improviser, she's also a scholar of early music, and so she's combining all her interests into one festival. So I'm kind of curious to see how that'll go.
Can you explain what a hurdy-gurdy is? I vaguely know what it is. I think I'd know it if I heard it, but I don't know what the mechanics of it are at all.
It's a multi-stringed instrument which is bowed using a wheel. So you turn the wheel with one hand, and it rubs up against the strings, causing them to sound, and you decide which string is sounding by depressing keys with the other hand.
Interesting.
It's an old, old, old instrument.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's hear a track off of this. KFJC 89.7 FM, the Fred Frith Special. And, okay, here we go. It's the compass, log, and lead. Lead. The compass, log, and lead. It's Fred Frith, Stevie Wishart, and Carla Kjellstedt here on 89.7.
Thank you. I'm sorry.